everyone. It is Tuesday, January 28th. We're still in the middle of the impeachment trial. The president's folks have been offering their defense. Oh, my God, Alan Dershowitz. Oh, my God, Alan Dershowitz. Anyway, read my tweets. I was stunned at the recreation and reinvention of the reading of the Constitution. But he's so good at it. You know, that's the thing, is that he knows how to package and he knows to make you feel so good. Like, I don't like Donald Trump. I voted for Hillary Clinton. Sure, I said something under the Clinton impeachment and yeah, this is 180 degrees the opposite. But this is about the idea of like coming to change your mind. The idea of becoming more enlightened. And I'm just listening to him. And I'm like, where is my shovel? Where is my shovel? And then all the conversation about Hunter and Joe Biden. Anyway, this is the attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes. I'm still kind of stunned at what I heard. But we knew that we were going to learn every sordid detail about the appearance of impropriety with Hunter and Joe. We knew it. You know, and unfortunately, Joe has not been very effective at dealing with it. And this was all done in prime time for only one audience, Fox and Trump. So that's why now they're all going, I didn't know. Isn't this terrible? And on that note, on this sort of mild day, Tuesday, what's up your sort of sleeve? And by the way, this immigration conversation, I thought of you, Ken Barnes, because I thought this is something that's really important. It deals with the Supreme Court and some other issues. And I have to thank one of our listeners, Ralph, because he sent me an email last night and I said, I'm on it. So between the two of you, I feel like I'm bookend. I love it.
Oh, good.
Yep.
Well, I want to talk a little bit today about something I heard about early preterm births and how the rate of non-full-term births is an indication of basically problems with the whole healthcare system,
right.
And kind of like a canary in a coal mine,
yeah.
And that America is not doing well in that regard, and especially black women, people of color, are having real problems with early term births, preterm births. And they talked to a woman who's a doctor in Mississippi, and first of all, she has a holistic approach to this whole thing, that it's not just a matter of getting better medical doctors, specialists, equipment, anything.
It isn't about like pregnancy. That. It's about health and the environment and the food.
Yeah,
and
it's your whole life, the circumstances that you grew up with and the stressors in your life. You know, you live in a stressful neighborhood and you've got a lot of discrimination or other things going on that make your life difficult and you're likely to give birth early. And
your body is a test tube.
Yeah.
And all those things affect the result of what's happening in the test tube.
And so this doctor is in Mississippi and she's talking about how there are only 20 specialists in neonatal care in Mississippi
in the entire state.
Yeah. And the woman that's interviewing her says, I'm interviewing you from Boston. And within walking distance of here, there are, you know, a dozen hospitals, each of which has more than 20 specialists.
Exactly.
And it's shocking the disparities.
Yeah.
And, of course,
it votes overwhelmingly Republican, Mississippi.
Well, but there's a lot of blacks who are overwhelmingly being treated as second-class citizens.
Exactly. Their votes are being
Mississippi.
Suppressed.
They're poor. They're discriminated against. And there's only 20 specialists. There are people who are trying to add services, like social-type services, where you go and you provide transportation to the mom when she needs it. You provide other things that she needs. You go to the hospital and make sure the doctors and nurses, whoever is there, are actually paying attention and doing right by the children. But it's an uphill battle, and it's a real problem that our society needs to worry about. And as I said, it's a kind of early birth is a canary in a coal mine. It means the whole healthcare system is not working.
Well, it's also look, they see their lives as expendable. And what they don't quite grasp is if you have low birth weight babies, there are long-term health consequences for them.
Mm-hmm.
There are long-term accomplishments in the sense of what they're able to do academically, what they're able to do to participate in society. So in a way, we are paying through the nose for that initial failure by not creating the right environment for these women. And it's not just about a doctor when they're pregnant.
Exactly.
It requires the whole right environment. It's really interesting you talked about pregnancy, and this was a conversation you had – you were listening to on public radio.
Mm-hmm.
So as a sidebar, you know, my daughter is living in Shanghai.
Right.
And they're obviously worried about coronavirus. Well, one of the big problems right now is it is the law in China that you must go to a hospital to have a baby. It is the law. Well, think about it. They had the one-child policy, so they needed to keep track.
Right.
So there was no way you could have a baby at home because they couldn't keep track of that baby because everybody was, you know, being identified very early. Well, now nobody wants to go to a hospital, and they're not sure they want pregnant women to come to a hospital.
Uh-oh.
So all of a sudden, the consequences of that policy is coming back, as Melissa says, to bite them in the you-know-what.
Yeah.
So I'm looking
because
at all
because they haven't developed any,
right,
any alternatives. Other alternatives.
Exactly, exactly, exactly.
Oh,
so I
gosh.
Just want everyone to know that, again, you look at one tiny piece of this and you think, I'll solve this problem. But then you realize it's a part of a bigger pattern that
right.
needs to be looked at very differently. And this is now coming back and really haunting the Chinese because they don't know what to do because they haven't planned for this kind of situation.
Right.
Unbelievable.
Right. That
unbelievable.
Is it's shocking. Pretty tragic
it
consequence of a pretty bad policy.
Yeah, well, there we go. We're at least – don't you feel good? China and the United States. Bad policies are us.
Yeah.
You know,
bad health care is
yeah,
us.
Yeah, bad health care is us. Well, actually, in some ways, they have better health care, but maybe not. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And
again, what is their health care is about control.
Mm.
Okay, it's not only about health. It was also about control.
Yeah, and in this country, as Elizabeth Warren says, healthcare system is working great for 1%,
yeah.
very wealthy, and
yeah,
God forbid
so,
the rest of us.
Exactly,
not so
exactly.
Much.
All right, everyone, we're going to begin our conversation today by kind of traveling to Iowa in a sort of way. Walter Shapiro will be joining us. He wrote a piece in the New Republic about Joe Biden. But before we get into that conversation about Joe Biden, I'm going to share with you what I posted on my Facebook page and why I went crazy this morning. So I'm up. It's about maybe 7 o'clock and I got my TV on. And of course, it's either on MSNBC or CNN and I don't know why. I probably should put my head under the pillow. And I am listening to the conversation on Morning Joe. And here is how I framed my post on Facebook. I'm listening to Morning Joe this morning as they expressed horror at the rise of Bernie Sanders in Iowa and New Hampshire. Then the table waxed poetic, describing Bernie as the crazy uncle in the closet. They show their collective shock that shutting him out of any coverage on their airwaves didn't control the trajectory of the voters. Where did Bernie come from, they wonder. How is this possible? They went – well, actually, I went BS and posted this on Facebook. Here we go, everyone. I also posted it on my Facebook page for The Attitude as well as my Facebook page. Oh, good. I'm so glad. We have Walter Shapiro. So, Walter, I'm going to force you to listen to this conversation before I grab you. This is what I posted on Facebook after I was listening to Morning Joe this morning, horrified at the rise of Bernie Sanders. Okay? This is what I wrote, Walter. I wasn't planning on you hearing it, but you're going to hear it anyway. The DNC is horrified at the rise of socialist Bernie. I am horrified at the rise of Goldman Sachs and its influence on every Democratic administration since Clinton. I am horrified at the rise of big banks, big insurance, big pharma, big ag. I am horrified at the spike in the gap between rich and poor. I am horrified at a foreign policy that falls in line with Bush Cheney and defined by endless wars in the military-industrial complex. I am horrified at a drop in college attendance but a spike in student debt. I am horrified at what the new Democratic Party has fed to my party, offering voters GOP light and not a choice. Time to change our diet. I'm a member of the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party, and I have more in common with the values and policies of Bernie, who models his plans on countries like Finland and Sweden and Norway and Denmark. And what do they have? A strong investment in their citizens, a healthier people, and a thriving, compassionate capitalism. Anyway, Walter Shapiro, that is what I wrote on Facebook this morning as I was listening to Morning Joe.
Oh, Arnie, I didn't want to get down this road.
No.
We're going to disagree tremendously.
I know we do. We're not going to disagree because we're not going to talk about this. We're going to talk about Joe Biden. So I called you to talk about your piece about Joe Biden, and I know you disagree with me completely on this one, but I am just going to tell you right now, I am horrified by what has happened under, quote-unquote, the Democrats. And that's part of the problem, is that when we had opportunity and we even controlled both House and Senate, did we actually do something significant to modify the results? And you and I both know, you know, I mean, they point to the ACA, but the ACA without a public option was an ACA that made insurance companies richer and, as well as Big Pharma. But let's
okay,
talk about
but,
Joe.
But
go on, go.
Every single Democrat, serious Democrat running is significantly to the left of the Barack Obama Rahm Emanuel approach to life in 2009
totally
and 2010
totally
when the
agree.
Democrats had congressional majority.
No. Let me just say something. I completely agree with you on this, Walter. We can sing Kumbaya. And the reason we can say that is that in a lot of ways, what Bernie did, whether he won or lost, isn't the point. What he did was he influenced the conversation in a lot of ways. Let's remember what Ross Perot did to Bill Clinton. Ross Perot influenced the conversation. Bill Clinton ran on a middle-class tax cut. Ross Perot talked about the pie charts, about the deficit, and who's the one who increased taxes but, you know, the guy who said he was running on a tax cut. So I understand it's not always about winning, but it is about changing the conversation. And for that reason, I am grateful to Bernie whether he wins or loses, because as you just pointed out, all of them are to the left of what we heard coming out of Barack Obama in 2008 and 2012.
I do have to mention, if we're going to talk about Ross Perot in 1992,
yes,
Paul Tsongas, the late Paul Tsongas, who won the 1992 New Hampshire primary, also played a role in making the Democrats a party of balanced budgets in the 90s.
So, Walter Shapiro, can I share something with you? Remember, I'm running for governor in 1992, and I am to give a speech with Tsongas' wife, because Tsongas couldn't make it, so she had never heard me speak. And after I finished giving my speech, which was kind of an eat your spinach speech, because that's who I was in 1992, Mrs. Tsongas turns to me and she says to the audience, "Oh, my God, she sounds like Paul." So I just want to let
like –
like Paul Tsongas. She said – and I want to remind you that Paul Tsongas won the Democratic Party, as you and I both know, and I won the New Hampshire primary running for governor, running against the party chairman and the five-term congressman, and I was an eat-your-spinach candidate. Do the math. Figure it out. Pay your bills. So there you go. And on that note, let's talk about Joe Biden.
Oh, God. I mean, it is – now, Joe Biden has many assets.
Mm-hmm.
Other than part of the Bernie wing of the party, mm-hmm. everyone likes him.
Oh, I like him, too.
I mean, number two, the amount that he has suffered in this life is more than anyone can bear, and that there is a sense of the hugs that he shares with other people who have suffered after his events in Iowa are genuine.
Mm-hmm.
Number three, I am told Biden's crowds this week are a bit better than when I saw them.
Okay.
That said, as I said in a New Republic cover story, I think it's still out, on Joe Biden, and this is based on covering him in New Hampshire and Iowa, you never have to worry about parking at a Biden event.
So let me just stop you on something. So can I tell you why his events are better attended? Now, remember, I have a lot of contacts in Iowa. I cover Iowa. I cover the caucus. I have people who join me every week. Two reasons why Biden's events are bigger, and that is he has no competition because they're stuck in the impeachment trial. Because a lot of the senators, Amy Klobuchar and Bernie, and all, yeah, three, exactly. So they don't have an alternative. So Biden and Mayor Pete, for the most part, maybe Andrew Yang, are like the shows in town. Okay, so that's right there, you've got a smaller world to compete with. The other reason, and this is not going to make you happy, is that I hang out with a lot of progressive groups in Iowa. No surprise, and the progressive groups in Iowa are now showing up at Biden events to talk to him about his policies and to challenge him about that. So it's not only supporters and people who have, you know, are trying to make up their mind who should they vote for in the Iowa caucus. It's also people who would normally be at a Bernie event or a Sanders event, or a Warren event, who are now also there saying, address these issues, Mr. Vice President.
And there's one other reason I would throw in, and that is that several other candidates have dropped out of the race,
yeah.
and their supporters are looking at the other candidates to see who they want
to
go for now.
But I will say, I was in Iowa on Tuesday,
mm-hmm.
and Joe Biden's crowds were 200 people in Ames, a college town, at lunchtime.
Right.
And I'm told that evening in Fort Dodge, it was no better.
Yeah, I know.
So, I mean, there is a sense normally in politics, crowds don't matter.
Right.
There are only two places in the known universe where I take crowd size seriously.
Yeah.
And shockingly enough, they are Iowa and New Hampshire.
I love you. So Walter, let me say something, because I read your article and then I posted it on my Facebook page, and here's how I framed it. If it's tepid support now, how is it going to change in November? And the reason I'm concerned about that is that it's not only about maybe convincing a couple of suburban housewives to vote for him over Donald Trump. Maybe it's about bringing back some of the people that didn't even show up in 2012 in 2016, because it was Tweedledum and Tweedledee for a lot of people because they didn't like either candidate. It is really about making sure that we can expand the base and get the young people that we've seen show up for Parkland and for the environment and for Bernie and for a lot of these people. How do we get them to stay engaged and maintain their level of enthusiasm and bring people in for that election, not just for a primary, but for an election? How does he do that?
Well, first of all, anyone who didn't vote in 2016, if they have not seen the error of their ways, they are beyond reachable.
No, I hear you.
I remember what the Nader vote in 2000 did to depress third-party voting in 2004, 2008, and 2012 on the left.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I really think that those people who didn't vote, either they will turn out because they realize the error of their ways, or they are, you don't want them to vote, because if they are not appalled by Trump by now, they may vote for Trump.
Well, and let me just say something else, and I think this is really important, in support of Joe Biden's candidacy. Now, remember, this is Arnie saying this, but when you look at approval ratings, so when you look at Hillary and Trump, they both went in with the highest negatives of any candidates running in history, okay? If you look, read Gallup or Pew or whatever.
I was in New Hampshire on election day, 2016, and I remember talking to a painting contractor in Nottingham at lunchtime, and I asked him, who do you vote for? He said, it's a long story. I said, I got the time. He said, well, I was going to go in and just vote for the down ballot races, but the more I stared at the ballot, the more I realized I hated Hillary a little more than I hated Trump, so I voted for Trump.
So listen to this. I hated Hillary. I hated Trump. I mean, here's the good news about Joe is that nobody hates him. He doesn't carry the baggage of Hillary.
Oh, no.
He doesn't walk. And so right there, from a hateability perspective, you look at Donald Trump and you look at Joe Biden, and at least you know all the reasons why you want to reject a Donald Trump. And while you may not be excited about a Joe Biden, you may think he's way too safe. You may think he may not address the urgency of the moment. You don't hate him because he is a nice guy. And he is someone who has at least some understanding, I mean, significant understanding of what the challenges are. I'm a little worried about his solutions, but if nothing else, he understands the challenges. But there isn't that visceral dislike for anyone. So your contractor in Nottingham would be able to know exactly what to do.
Add to which, in a cover story for the New Republic, which I think is still out there.
It is still out there.
An earlier piece. I really liken him to Jerry Ford.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
A president who looks a lot better with a hindsight of 40 years,
right,
who came in after a president tried to destroy the Constitution and was a reassuring transitional figure.
So let me just ask a question, which I think is incredibly real. And that is that do we have time for a transitional figure? And I'm saying this brutally honestly because I am looking at what is happening on the globe. I am looking what is happening with climate. I am looking what is happening between the resentment because of the incredible rise of the wealthy. I'm looking at what is happening with healthcare and the heroin addiction and the number of people that we are losing now as a result of that. I am looking at that and I am wondering, transition was a possibility for a Ford given the time. Do we live in a time of urgency where transition defines failure, not possibility?
Three things.
Okay.
Number one, Biden, in his stump speeches, talks a lot about how America is only responsible for 15% of the greenhouse gases. This is not to deny America. Biden is not doing this to deny American responsibility, but to argue that he and only he has the foreign policy connections, the connections to world leaders, to mobilize an international effort to really mitigate the effects of global warming.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a real case to be made in that regard, mm-hmm. in the sense that part of it is if the Brazil is destroying the rainforest,
right.
and China and India are wedded to coal, all the feel-good environmental efforts in this country, as necessary as they are, will not solve the problem.
Can you imagine if we had a trade war that said, deal with coal, we'll help you pay for moving off the coal teat? Imagine if we had a trade war that said to Brazil, we know how much money you're making by burning down the Amazon. We're going to give you the cash for it, because we just moved $35 trillion around in the Pentagon in 1 year. $35 trillion we moved around in the Pentagon. And that's not all the money in the Pentagon. We have the capacity not only to have connections with world leaders, but actually to understand the power and influence of money in how people make choices and how countries make choices.
We also have the power if we work in conjunction with Japan and the EU.
Yeah. Well, so let me ask this question. If you got the nomination, Walter Shapiro, you were Joe Biden.
Can I pause here?
Yeah.
About 1956, about 1950, Margaret Chase Smith, the Republican moderate senator from Maine, was asked by a reporter, what would you do if you found yourself in the White House?
Yeah.
And she said memorably, I would get dressed, I'd go home, and I would apologize to Mrs. Truman.
All right. So, but apologize to Mrs. Truman. But so you know where I'm going. If Joe Biden wants to send a message that not only is a message to the country, but also a message to the fractured Democratic base of the Democratic Party, who would you be looking at as a vice president? Vice presidents have no meaning, but they also do send messages.
Oh, you know, they both send a message, and I think we all should assume that Joe Biden would be a one-term president.
Exactly. So if you're looking around, who delivers the message that would not only bring the party together with a sense of reassurance, but also would speak to the nation in a sense that says, you know, I understand about restoring a sense of civility and stability here. If you're give me a short list of three or four people.
Well, I can't, because I deeply believe that vice presidents are picked based on the polling surrounding the de facto presidential nominee 3 weeks before the convention, and what are his deficiencies.
Right. But we know the deficiencies now. We don't even need to poll. Come on, Walter. This is a punt. I mean, you and I could list the deficiencies. We'd go through like three encyclopedias before we were done. The question isn't about his deficiencies. It's also about messaging. Because deficiencies, you couldn't fill the room with the number of people, because I think there are significant deficiencies. But I do think that there's a power in a message. And you know he was concerned about that, which was one of the reasons why he was talking to gubernatorial candidate from Georgia, Stacey Abrams, early on, because he understood from the get-go he needed to message that he not only understood the need to sort of embrace the black vote, but also a message because she is so grounded, I think, in rational politics.
Well, you can make the argument that he could play the Midwest card,
Amy.
From Sherrod Brown to Amy Klobuchar.
Yeah.
You could make the Elizabeth Warren point. You could start looking at young members of the Senate for some energy, like Chris Murphy in Connecticut, who has been terrific on guns.
Yeah.
Certainly Kamala Harris is jockeying for this in her own mind.
Oh, totally.
You don't know what is needed. But what I have heard Biden say and talk for 10 minutes at various town meetings is how important he considers the vice presidential choice in terms of chemistry with the president.
Well, and he knows that better than anyone after 8 years with Barack Obama, because he can talk chemistry because it's been 8 years of chemistry. And didn't he get some medal from Barack Obama at the time that he left? So, I mean, he can speak to it because it was
so
important.
The Nobel Prize in chemistry he got from
Obama. All right. Here we go. Joe Biden's confounding candidacy. The former vice president is drawing tiny, unenthused crowds in Iowa. So why is he still one of the front runners? By Walter Shapiro. I love you, Walter. We'll see you when you get to New Hampshire.
Well, trust me, you know where I will be five or 6 days before a certain primary.
All right, I'll see you soon. Bye-bye. Take care, Walter.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. This is The Attitude with Artie Artisan and Ken Barnes. A little labor history is next.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1932. That was the day the first unemployment insurance law was established in the United States. It happened in Wisconsin. Governor Philip La Follette signed the Unemployment Compensation Act. La Follette had a reputation as a progressive leader. Under the new law, employers were required to contribute to a fund based on their payrolls. Many across Wisconsin were out of work due to the Great Depression. But not all workers were covered by the act. Farm workers, domestic workers, railroad workers, teachers, and loggers were among those excluded. Employers with less than 10 workers also did not have to participate. Due to the Great Depression, it took a while to build up enough money in the insurance pool to actually pay out benefits. California, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, New York, Utah, and Washington soon followed Wisconsin's lead. Then, in 1935, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed the Social Security Act into law. Part of this act was to encourage states to establish unemployment insurance systems for their workers. The first unemployment insurance benefit check went to Niles Rudd of Madison, Wisconsin, on August 17, 1936. He was an out-of-work photo engraver. He received the maximum allowable benefit of $15. Today, unemployment insurance programs remain a federal-state partnership administered under state laws. That means each state has a different maximum dollar amount and length of time the benefits can be used. Recently, unemployment insurance protections have been rolled back in some states. Since 2011, Arkansas, Florida, Georgia, Illinois, Kansas, Michigan, Missouri, and North and South Carolina have all cut the amount of time that people can receive unemployment benefits. In North Carolina, that length dropped from 26 weeks down to just 14.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. When you see an actor in handcuffs, they're usually filming a movie. But when Jane Fonda, Ted Danson, Sally Field, and other celebrities were arrested in Washington, D.C. last fall, the only cameras rolling were from the news media.
When you're famous, there's a real responsibility to use that celebrity in the best possible way you can.
Jane Fonda began leading weekly demonstrations called Fire Drill Fridays at the U.S. Capitol last October. The goal was to raise awareness about the climate crisis and demand that the country transition away from fossil fuels. Over the fall, Fonda and other protesters were arrested multiple times for civil disobedience. She even spent a night behind bars. Fonda says before she started Fire Drill Fridays, she felt depressed and helpless about global warming.
I wasn't doing enough, and I didn't know what to do.
But inspired by Greta Thunberg and other young activists, Fonda decided it was time to join the climate movement. She says now, instead of just sitting around feeling scared about the future, she feels empowered and even hopeful.
We have the future in our hands. What an awesome responsibility and what a beautiful opportunity.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
The beggar at the side of the road says, brother, any spare change? You glare straight ahead, don't encourage them, you say, and walk up that progress hill. Shall we walk up the progress hill, dear friends, where the rules are all that matter? Where your heart is colder than winter snow. We will walk, we will walk together. In the dead of night, there's a knock on the door. The urgent voice tells you to flee. You must find a safe place, your freedom. There's no cue when you run for your life. Hallelujah, hallelujah. You must find a safe place, your freedom. There's no cue when you run for your life.
Everyone, a refugee's ballad. Who sings that? That's just gorgeous.
It is. That's Kavisha Mizell.
Wow.
And the subtitle of a refugee ballad is All God's Children.
Wow. It's just incredible. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. He picks our music, which is just incredible on this part. So I mentioned that we talk a lot about immigration policy with Ken. One of my sort of avid listeners sent me an email just the other day about the Supreme Court decision dealing with immigration. And I totally admire our next guest, who is an expert on immigration. Mm-hmm. So as I was swirling around with Supreme Court decisions and Ken and Ralph, I realized I needed to reach out to Tyler Moran. Tyler is the director of the Immigration Hub. She has been with the organization since its founding She has 20 years of experience developing and implementing immigration policy. You worked with Barack Obama. We have called you on many occasions. And more exciting, you are from New Hampshire. So I love it. Who knew? So, you know, he played that song about refugees. And I have two pieces here because you didn't write a piece. I read pieces. And one of the pieces I read was a piece by Mark Joseph Stern. And the piece, because he's just a fabulous writer at Slate.com, the title of his piece was "The Supreme Court Lets Trump Punish Immigrants Who May Be, Quote, A Public Charge. The court's conservatives green light another overreach without explanation." And Tyler, I hope you will forgive me, but if I can read just a couple of sentences from Mark Joseph Stern, I think it will actually lay a great foundation for our conversation. "On Monday, the Supreme Court's conservative majority allowed the Trump administration's public charge rule to take effect. The government may now begin to deny visas and green cards to anyone it decides may rely on public aid. Monday's order will force countless immigrants to forego health care, food stamps, and housing assistance. It will drive families to illness, starvation, and homelessness, and it is impossible to square with federal law. The 5-4 decision is both a humanitarian catastrophe and an act of rank hypocrisy. The same conservative justices who rail against executive lawmaking by federal bureaucrats approved a policy written by bureaucrats that radically alters the laws passed by Congress. The public charge rule furthers Trump's effort to limit legal immigration by any means." And that's how he begins. So with that outrage on the part of Mark Joseph Stern, Tyler Moran, explain to us what the question was to the court, what the court decided, and whether you mirror the fear of Mark Joseph Stern.
Sure. Thanks, Arnie. And I think what he said at the end about this administration wanting to limit legal immigration is right on, because Trump often rails about undocumented immigrants and sanctuary cities. But what they have done since they came into office is basically institute a number of policies that are slashing who can come into the country. So they're essentially barring anyone who isn't white, highly educated, and wealthy. So just a little background, public charge has been around since the late 1800s as a means to exclude people from this country. And up until the rule issued by the Trump administration, it essentially was a test of if someone was likely to become primarily dependent on the government for subsistence. And this applies when someone wants to come to the country or they want to get a green card. So I'm going to bring us back actually to the mid-1990s. You remember the welfare law that Bill Clinton passed?
Of course.
Well, after he passed that law, which actually restricted the public benefits that legal immigrants could get, there was a lot of fear and people stopped getting health care for their kids or food stamps for their kids. And so Bill Clinton actually came out with a policy in 1999 that said exactly what public charge was and what it wasn't. And basically what it was that someone could be restricted from coming to the country if they primarily depend on cash assistance or long-term like healthcare institutionalization, but explicitly did not include benefits that help working poor families like Medicaid and food stamps. So what the Trump administration did is they came in and they essentially created a wealth test to immigrate to the United States. So not only you referenced in that article that it expands the list of benefits that can count against someone.
Right.
So now things like Medicaid and food stamps and housing can count against someone. But a lot of people who don't have a green card aren't eligible. And I think what's really damaging is this new test that they're applying to people. Basically, it's looking at people's income, their age, and their education and skill level. And so for a family of four that earns less than $32,000, that counts against them. For a family who has kids under 18 or adults over 61, that counts against them. People with limited English proficiency. So you can see how this can really change the composition of immigrants that are coming into the United States. Now, I'm going to skip because you asked about the Supreme Court ruling, but I'd really like to actually go into some of the consequences of this rule. So basically, there are a number of lawsuits that were filed by a few states, New York, Connecticut, Vermont. And there's a district court in New York that actually issued a nationwide injunction against the rule. And the judge said that the rule was repugnant to the American dream. And so what the Supreme Court decision did was lift that national injunction so the rule can go into place. It's important to note, though, that these other lawsuits in the lower courts can still proceed on their merits, and potentially the regulation could be overturned on its merits in the future. But right now, the rule can be implemented.
So I'm reacting emotionally on two levels. My first reaction is that when they passed the Welfare Reform Act, and as you pointed out, it included that public charge and it was pretty egregious. Mm-hmm. In 1996, I ran against that Welfare Reform Act for exactly that reason. For exactly that reason, I lost. They said, oh, she can't even agree with Bill Clinton. Turns out Bill Clinton couldn't agree with Bill Clinton because, as you just pointed out, he had to amend it. You know, he had to soften that public charge so that it wasn't as egregious as we first initially described it. So I get the public charge because, in part, I lost my congressional race because of that story. The second thing is that I want people to understand about needing assistance, because we are now denying people based on what we assume they may need in the future. And it is outrageous. We only want white, wealthy people to come here. And therefore, this is a way of making sure that people who are dark, who don't have income or whatever, don't actually achieve what you and I just described as the American dream. And I think you – I don't know if you heard me tell this story before, Tyler, but I was giving an award out in Massachusetts to five of the most prominent women in Massachusetts. I don't know if it was called the Susan B. Anthony Award or whatever, but I was like the out-of-towner who was there to MC the event and give the award out. We're in the green room, Tyler, and we're talking before they come out on the stage. It turns out of the six of us, five of us had been on welfare. Five of the six. No. The only woman who had not been on welfare, guess what? L.D. Acheson, Dean Acheson's daughter. The rest of us had needed some kind of financial assistance, and every single person on that stage was important and a pillar and a success to the community. But for welfare, where would they be today? So it's not just about these people who legally have a right to come here. But I want people to understand that it is not a sign of failure. It is not a stigma. It is recognizing just the fact of life. And yet they're not allowed to have lives. And that's really what this public charge suggests. Sorry.
Well, it's because we don't have a living wage in this country that working poor families need to access things like Medicaid and food assistance.
Right.
So
right.
It's for people who actually are working but a full-time job can't meet their needs. I want to highlight actually the Migration Policy Institute, which has looked at this rule. They went back and looked at the past 5 years about people who had applied for green cards,
right.
And they found that 69% of those people had at least one of these negative factors that could count against them.
Oh my God.
And so what they have found that this test is really going to disproportionately affect women, children, and the elderly, and is likely going to shift legal immigration away from Latin America towards Europe. So this isn't, you know, the alarm bells going off is not, you know, this is something that if you look at people who have come into the country and you look at the facts, it really is going to change the face of this country. And already we've seen the impact of this rule just based on fear in Texas, 150,000 fewer people accessing Medicaid. WIC, the program for pregnant moms and babies, right. 18 states say drops in 20%. I mean, people are afraid. And so even people who are eligible for assistance are not getting it because of the fear. And that's why they did it. They did it out of cruelty, and they did it to create fear and confusion.
And this is, I'm going to go back. People should just be on my Facebook page, because one of the things I also pointed out was that at a time when we are looking at issues of national security, it turns out that healthcare is really a component of national security. As we're talking about China and the coronavirus and the number of people right now have been diagnosed and the concern about, you know, how do you prevent this from spreading here? This is the worst time to suggest to people that you shouldn't be able to access healthcare. This is the worst time to drive people into the shadows, to tell them that even if they qualified for Medicaid, they shouldn't get it. This is the worst time, because just when you want to make sure people are being monitored with their health, this is what the Trump administration is doing. A pox on them, because if nothing else, people need to see the connection between what they're doing and the potential consequence. And especially in Texas, as you know this, Tyler Moran, Texas has the lowest rate of insured people in America to start. Mm-hmm. They have incredibly high numbers of underinsured. They have incredibly high numbers of people who are both legal immigrants and undocumented immigrants. This is a place where you could create a toxic brew if you're worried about some kind of a disease spreading, because Texas would be the greatest, you know, petri dish for it to happen.
Mm-hmm. It's created incredible fear. I mean, people are not going for themselves. They're not going for their U.S. citizen children. I mean, it's incredible. I mean, one in four kids in this country has a foreign-born parent. And so if you think about, you know, really the impact of this rule, it's very, very far-reaching. There's a couple other policies that were introduced this week that, again, get at this goal of the administration to really prevent immigrants from coming to the United States and actually changing the face of immigrants that are coming to the United States.
And that's the pregnancy profiling, as what I hear it's called.
Yep.
And what I posted was on Twitter, I think I said something like, you've heard of driving while black? This is now traveling while pregnant. I just want, and basically what I said is, when did they come after you? I mean, this is really a continuation. So explain to my friends who are listening, what is pregnancy profiling? This is so important for people to hear.
Well, the Trump administration calls this a birth tourism ban. We call it a handmaid's test that turns consular officers into pregnancy reproductive policemen. So basically what it said is that this new regulation that came out of the State Department said that a consular officer abroad can bar women and girls from visiting the United States if they look pregnant. So someone may be presumed to be traveling to the United States to give birth and could be barred from visiting unless she can prove she's not pregnant. So a couple weeks ago, I don't know if anyone saw the story about a woman traveling from Hong Kong who was not pregnant and was forced by the airline to take a pregnancy test with the airline employee there before being allowed to board an airplane. And the woman was not pregnant and described the situation as humiliating and frustrating. So can you imagine? People are going to be profiled by the way their bodies look. They are going to be forced to take tests that they did not consent to in order to travel. So the administration, you mentioned that, you know, they often justify their policies based on national security, and they actually did that for this. But it's a ridiculous justification, given that there are already procedures in place to prosecute any criminal networks that could try to organize people, you know, for travel under false premises. This is an attack on women.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Could I just ask a question? You were talking about the policy allowing Border Patrol to stop anyone who looks pregnant. I thought the policy even
worse. Consular officers abroad.
Even worse. Also includes anyone who they have reason to believe, whatever that means, intends to come to the U.S. in order to give birth. So they might
That's
not even be pregnant.
Right.
They just may be young enough to and have a family.
And fertile.
To be
think- young and fertile. Young and, oh God, there
to
we
be
go.
Thinking maybe
so,
they'll get
so
pregnant.
So think about
sometime.
This. They don't want me to have an abortion. They want to limit my access to birth control. And now, I mean, this is like, they're getting you coming one way and going the other. So the, I mean, it's just, it is, I want people to understand how unbelievably controlling this is. I want every woman to understand that this is an assault on her. You don't have to be coming from somewhere else. This is an assault on you. They're checking off the list, Tyler. It is just so shocking. And women are the target.
That's right. Exactly.
Oh,
Planned Parenthood and different women's rights groups have come out, you know, against this rule. And then there's another one that came out this week. We're just in January. So if folks remember the Muslim ban that went into effect,
yes.
Well, there's a new Muslim and African ban. It hasn't come out yet, but based on media reports, it's going to ban travel and green cards for immigrants from several African and Muslim majority countries. So, again, as with the previous Muslim ban, they will base it on national security. But the Cato Institute actually, you know, came out with a report that pointed out that not a single person from these countries that were named, Eritrea, Tanzania, Nigeria, has killed a single American on our soil since 1975. There's an interesting article in The Atlantic where it talks about how this administration is really extending its targeting of Latinos and Muslims to African immigrants and points to some coverage on Fox News and the Ann Coulter book. You know, talking about Nigerians and that the problem that we have Nigerian immigrants, you remember that Trump called immigrants from Africa coming from shithole countries.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm.
You know, Nigeria is a country where immigrants actually are twice as likely to have a bachelor's degree than Americans as a whole. So again, this is about barring people based on race.
So I guess here's my question. As we're having this conversation, and I mentioned on the air the other day, you know, impeachment has like, you know, completely enveloped us. That's all you see on MSNBC. It's all you see on CNN. When you read the headlines, all the headlines are about John Bolton and his damn freaking book. And I'm listening to these stories. So here's what I'm trying to figure out. Julian Castro spoke a lot about immigration. He's no longer in this race. He did, however, endorse Elizabeth Warren. Do you see any of the potential 2020 candidates who can tell this story? Because this isn't just – I want everyone to understand. This is not just an assault on someone else from another country. This ultimately is an assault on you. We need to make sure that people understand. It's so easy to other people because I haven't arrived here yet. But in reality, it is much, much more insidious than that. It starts with the other, but it actually, the target is on your back. Which candidate is good at that?
I'm glad you asked about the 2020 election because this is the primary strategy for Donald Trump, just as it was in 2016. Mm-hmm. This is his strategy in 2020. And if you look in the past 8 months just of his Facebook spending, he spent $2.9 million on immigration ads just on Facebook. This doesn't include Google and other platforms. This is more than any other Democratic presidential candidate combined. So all of them have platforms out there that are solid platforms that focus on fixing the immigration system, that we need to create a path to citizenship for people in the country. We need to reform the way that people can come to this country legally, and we need to overturn Donald Trump's policies. The problem is in the first two debates, people sort of got these gotcha questions that focused on the more controversial aspects of immigration policy. And what we really need to see in the next debates is like an honest conversation about what it takes to fix the system. And I think based on polling we've done, both the Democratic base and swing voters agree with Democrats. They don't want to hear all this, you know, xenophobic language and separating families. They actually agree with Democrats that we need to fix the solution.
But, you know, it is, again, I want everyone to understand, what is the American dream? What is the American dream? It is coming with nothing. And this is the land of opportunity. And now he's saying, come with checks in your wallet, you know, and be white. I mean, this is so the opposite of everything that we have imagined. And as I'm looking at this, so there's a group that fights the whole issue of the gap between rich and poor. They're called Patriotic Millionaires. So I guess I got to ask you, Tyler, since you've been in this field forever, is there a group of kind of like patriotic immigrants that get up there and say, see this? I run your hospital. Let me tell you about how I arrived. Here's this. I run your company. See the thousands I employ? This is how I arrived. And I almost like, we, in a lot of ways, pictures are important. And we need to begin to see people stand up because they can tell the story better than an Arnie. You know, I was born in Bay Ridge. You know, I can't tell that story. But someone who was born in Bangladesh could. And I'm wondering whether we are beginning to see people look at these policies and use their voices, use their sphere of influence, and use their ability to get attention because they're so important to our economy and our future.
Absolutely. I mean, and history is going to be on our side. I mean, when I look at the people that are now engaged in the fight against Donald Trump, pediatricians, faith leaders, national security experts saying, actually, this is making us less safe. So there are so many voices out there that are pushing back against these xenophobic, cruel, and chaotic policies. And I think, as I said, you know, history is going to be on our side. You know, the fact that all these people have stood up for the right thing.
Well, Tyler, as I'm thinking about what's going to happen, we've got the Iowa caucus coming up. We've got the New Hampshire primary coming up. There is someone that's not in those primaries or caucuses. And he is the eighth richest person in the United States. His name is Michael Bloomberg. So I have to just ask Tyler, since he's willing to pardon the expression, piss his money away.
Right.
What about Bloomberg on immigration policy? Mm-hmm. Do you remember him when he was the mayor of New York? Can you tell me whether I know he puts money into climate change. I know he puts money into guns. I am kind of curious, what does our Democratic billionaire think about immigration policy? And have you ever had a conversation with him?
I haven't, but New York City has a number of progressive policies that really should be modeled for other cities.
Okay.
And he does support immigration reform. He has put money into trying to, you know, have a solution for the system. And if you look again, there's this great website. It's called Bully Pulpit. It's sort of this tracker of spending.
Okay.
He has put money behind immigration ads. And I think, you know, regardless of who becomes our nominee, the fact that he's spending money against Donald Trump right now is a good thing.
All right. So I'm going to be at the ABC table the night of the New Hampshire primary debate, right before the New Hampshire primary. Lucky Arnie. And I know that you are an important player in Washington and that you're an important player in immigration. Do me a favor. Get the Washington Post or the New York Times or the Boston Globe or some paper to run an op-ed by you and have you write a series of questions and give people the reason why these questions are critical now, in part because of what the Supreme Court did, in part because of pregnancy profiling, in part because women are going to be so critical to the 2020 campaign, in part because women of color are going to be so important. I think it's really important that before they – because you know that these questions are going to be decided way in advance, and we also know that sometimes you don't have to necessarily answer the question you're being given, and that if you even suggest a question, you might get an answer from one of those people standing on that stage that responds to the questions you've suggested, because we are so focused on something else that these things that you have told us in rapid succession have happened, and it's just January, and I want people to know how important they are because we need to focus on them.
So, absolutely.
All right, Tyler Moran, that's your assignment.
Absolutely.
I love
Thanks
you.
For calling, Arnie.
All right, you're welcome.
Take care.
You're welcome. Tyler Moran is an immigration expert, as you could obviously tell. She runs something called the Immigration Hub. If Tyler Moran writes something, you pass it around. If you have a presidential candidate in front of you, you grab some of these issues dealing with immigration and you say, what do you think about this? Will you speak about this? Will you bring it up during the course of the debates? You have an obligation. Impeachment, he'll be around. You know that. The question is, we'll be around after the election in 2020. That's up to us. All right, everyone. How do we end this program?
Wow. That was pretty amazing. We end with Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers singing Refugee.
Here we go, everyone.
Ain't no real big secret, all the same, somehow. I've tired of taking away their friends.